Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in different US and European cities since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1180, I will have several segments. First, we will talk about apartheid Israel's forced starvation of the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip, causing a famine. I will air the remarks of Tom Fletcher, United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, speaking on that topic. After that, we will listen to the remarks of Wissam Ahmed on behalf of Al-Haq organization, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal about Israel's attacks on the healthcare infrastructure. During the third segment, I will air most of the remarks delivered at a CARE Florida press conference on the abduction of a 15-year-old American citizen by the Israeli occupation army. And during the fourth segment, I will air Greater Israel Explained, the Israeli plan to conquer the Arab world by breakthrough news. On August 22, 2025, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, system reported that more than 500,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are experiencing famine, with the number due to rise to more than 640,000 by the end of September 2025. This famine is a direct result of apartheid Israel's forced starvation and prevention of food and other life necessities from entering the Gaza Strip, not even baby formulas, while at the same time continuing its genocide, war crimes, atrocities, and slaughter of the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. Tom Fletcher, United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, spoke about the famine in Gaza and pleaded to allow food and aid into the Gaza Strip.
Please read the IPC report, cover to cover. Read it in sorrow and in anger. Not as words and numbers, but as names and lives. Be in no doubt that this is irrefutable testimony. It is a famine, the Gaza famine. It is a famine that we could have prevented if we had been allowed. Yet food stacks up at borders because of systematic obstruction by Israel. It is a famine within a few hundred meters of food in a fertile land. It is a famine that hits the most vulnerable first, each with a name, each with a story, that strips people of dignity before it strips them of life, that forces a parent to choose which child to feed, that forces people to risk their lives to seek food. It is a famine that we repeatedly warned of, but that the international media has not been allowed in to cover, to bear witness. It is a famine in 2025, a 21st century famine, watched over by drones and the most advanced military technology in history. It is a famine openly promoted by some Israeli leaders as a weapon of war. It is a famine on all of our watch. Everyone owns this. The Gaza famine is the world's famine. It is a famine that asks, but what did you do? A famine that will and must haunt us all. It is a predictable and a preventable famine. A famine caused by cruelty, justified by revenge, enabled by indifference, and sustained by complicity. It is a famine that must spur the world to more urgent action, that must shame the world to do better. It is a famine that therefore also asks, and what now will you do? My ask, my plea, my demand to Prime Minister Netanyahu and anyone who can reach him. Enough. Ceasefire. Open the crossings, north and south, all of them. Let us get food and other supplies in, unimpeded and at the massive scale required. End the retribution. It is too late for far too many, but not for everyone in Gaza. Enough. For humanity's sake, let us in.
That was Tom Fletcher, United Nations Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. I have a link to the full IPC report on the famine in Gaza posted on our website, arabvoices.net. In May 2025, a historic Gaza tribunal, a gathering of international experts and human rights defenders united to expose and address the crimes committed by Israel in Gaza, was held in Sarajevo. There were several speakers at that tribunal, and I had aired some of them over the past few weeks on this program. And during this episode of Arab Voices, I will air another talk delivered at the International Law Chamber about specific acts. Let's listen to Wissam Ahmed speaking on behalf of Al-Haq organization about Israel's attacks on the healthcare infrastructure. And the voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Nimer Soltani, a Palestinian legal scholar and reader in public law at SOAS University of London, who moderated that panel, introducing the speaker.
Next is Dr. Wissam Ahmed, who is the director of the Center for Applied International Law at Al-Haq organization and the coordinator of its business and human rights program. Al-Haq is a leading Palestinian human rights organization based in Ramallah. Dr. Ahmed's area of research focuses on the economic incentive structure which perpetuates the colonization of Palestine along business lines. He has a JD from Louisiana State University and graduate degrees in law and a doctorate from the Irish Center for Human Rights in Galway, Ireland. And he'll be talking about the attacks on healthcare. The floor is yours. Please help me welcome Wissam.
Thank you very much, Maryam, for laying the groundwork for these principles of international humanitarian law that we see being completely dismantled. And I think the example of looking at the systematic destruction of Gaza's healthcare system is a very important example to highlight this. But before I start, I want to acknowledge the important work that was done by Al-Haq's legal research and advocacy team, our monitoring and documentation department, and all the work that went into putting this submission together. I've merely been tasked with presenting the submission, so I hope I will do it justice. So starting with the first slide we have here, through the demonstrated intent to destroy the healthcare system in the Gaza Strip, Israel is inflicting genocide against the Palestinian people as Israel, one, targets and kills healthcare workers, two, causes serious bodily injury and mental harm to the Palestinian people by deliberately preventing access to healthcare and life-saving humanitarian aid, and three, deliberately inflicts conditions of life on the Palestinian people calculated to bring about their destruction in whole or in part by collapsing the entire healthcare system in the Gaza Strip. So evidence of Israeli officials, dolus specialis, to commit genocide has been significant, persistent, and overt since October 2023 and before. Incitement to genocide on the part of Israeli officials, combined with acts of killing, injuring, and disappearing healthcare workers and the other civilians, as well as systematically destroying all 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip, some repeatedly, points to both direct and indirect evidence of genocidal intent. Indeed, healthcare workers, civilians, and hospitals have been signaled out for targeting. You have Gura Eland, a reservist major general, former head of the Israeli National Security Council and advisor to the Minister of Defense, wrote in an Israeli newspaper on the 19th of November, 2023, that it is precisely Gaza's civil collapse that will bring an end to the war closer. When senior Israeli figures say in the media, it's either us or them, we should clarify the question, who is them? They are not only Hamas fighters with weapons, but also all the civilian officials, including hospital administrators and school administrators, and also the entire Gaza population, who enthusiastically supported Hamas on October 7th. This is a quote. Another quote from Moshe Filin, an Israeli politician and leader of Zehut, a political party that advocates for West Bank annexation, stated in a TV interview on the 23rd of October, 2023, there is one and only one solution, which is to completely destroy Gaza before invading it. And when I talk about destruction, I mean destruction like it was done in Dresden, Hiroshima. But if you do them like it was done to Dresden, like what the British did, and if you burned everything, and if you threw the bombs to penetrate defensive structures, to penetrate Al-Shifa Hospital, and to destroy the ground from beneath it without any consequences. These statements have been complemented by Israeli officials making unsubstantiated statements about hospitals serving as command and control centers and hideouts, as well as unsubstantiated statements about Palestinian doctors involved in terrorist activities, who themselves have been detained, tortured, and even killed in Israeli prison camps. The killing of healthcare workers specifically. Israel has deliberately targeted, detained, tortured, and killed healthcare workers in the Gaza Strip. Between October 2023 and May 2025, Israel killed more than 1,600 healthcare workers in Gaza. From the period of October 2023 to January 2024, Israeli occupying forces, IOF, killed healthcare workers in Gaza at a rate of 5 per day. As of April 2025, at least 412 humanitarian aid workers, including 291 UN staff, were killed by Israeli forces. The World Health Organization has recorded 720 attacks on healthcare infrastructure in Gaza between October 2023 and May 2025. One of the most notable attacks on healthcare includes the killing of 5-year-old Hind Rajab. In January 2024, paramedics Yusuf Zeno and Ahmed El-Madhoun were killed by the IOF when their ambulance was struck with a tank shell as they attempted to rescue Hind, despite coordinating their route with Israeli forces beforehand. Hind, injured and alone, died waiting for rescuers that never arrived. Most recently, on the 23rd of March, 2025, Israel deliberately executed 15 paramedics and emergency rescue workers while they were responding to an emergency call in Rafah. After a week-long search, their bodies, along with the ambulances, were found buried in a mass grave. Israel detained at least 339 healthcare workers by February 2025. And of those 339, 96 who were released have testified that they were subjected to torture, ill treatment, deprivation of food and water, threats of rape and sexual violence, and degrading treatment while in Israeli detention. The UN Commission of Inquiry on the OPT has determined that the mistreatment of Palestinian detainees by Israeli authorities is the result of an intentional policy. One surgeon testified that prison guards were given instructions to deliberately damage his hands, stating they wanted to make sure that I could never return to work. At least 4 healthcare workers have been killed in Israeli custody. Dr. Iyad Rantisi, head of obstetrics department at Kamal Adwan Hospital, was detained on the 11th of November, 2023. He was killed 6 days later as a result of torture and ill treatment in Shikma prison, where he was interrogated by the Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency. Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh, head of orthopedic department at Al-Shifa Hospital, was detained on the 18th of December, 2023. Dr. Al-Bursh was killed in Ofer prison in April 2024, with signs of torture on his body. He was reportedly raped to death. Dr. Ziyad Al-Dalu, an internal medicine physician, was taken by Israeli forces from Al-Shifa Hospital on the 18th of March, 2024. Just 3 days later, on 21 March, Dr. Dalu was killed in Israeli custody. Mr. Hamdan Hassan Al-Naba, a senior paramedic at Nasser Hospital, was detained by the IOF on the 2nd of December, 2023, while evacuating patients south along the Israeli designated safe route. his family was informed in September 2024 that he was killed in Israeli custody. Israel is still withholding their bodies. Israel has deliberately inflicted serious bodily and mental harm on the Palestinian people through the destruction of the healthcare system in Gaza, including by directly attacking healthcare workers and hospitals themselves, by annihilating Gaza's healthcare system, thereby preventing the Palestinian people from accessing basic critical medical care while subjecting the population to constant bombardment and airstrikes that place them in dire need of medical intervention to prevent death or debilitating injury. Israel is causing serious bodily and mental harm to the Palestinians in Gaza. As of May 2025, Israel has killed over 53,000 Palestinians and injured more than 120,000 more. Disease, dehydration, and famine are spreading rapidly throughout the Gaza Strip, as Israel has imposed a total blockade on any food, water, fuel, or medicine entering Gaza since the 2nd of March, 2025. The longest period of a total siege in the Gaza Strip. Forced starvation and the spread of disease has serious implications for the future development of Palestinian children, in particular, and their right to health. By March 2024, all 335,000 children under the age of 5 in Gaza were at high risk for severe malnutrition, which carries severe developmental consequences. Children are now dying from starvation in Gaza. At least 26 Palestinians were killed by starvation, mostly children and elderly, within 24 hours on 20 May 2025, with many more expected to die in the coming days. By July 2024, the polio virus made a resurgence in the Gaza Strip for the first time since it was eradicated 25 years ago. As a result, 602,000 children are vulnerable to permanent paralysis and chronic disabilities. Israeli officials have stated plainly, there is only one solution, which is to completely destroy Gaza, and that all basic necessities, including food, water, fuel, and electricity, would be prevented from entering Gaza, because, I quote, we are fighting human animals, and we act accordingly. This is a member of the Knesset, Osher Shaklim, stated with regard to giving Palestinians access to humanitarian aid. I wouldn't even give them a crumb of bread, neither to Gaza nor to Hamas. I wouldn't bring them a drop of water. Thus, any mental harm inflicted from the forced starvation, lack of access to basic resources, and destruction of healthcare services was deliberately imposed by Israel in its pursuit to destroy Palestinians in Gaza in whole or in part. Israel has deliberately targeted, destroyed, or rendered inoperable all 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip in violation of international humanitarian law principles, protecting hospitals and medical establishments during an armed conflict. The direct targeting and destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in the occupied Palestinian territory, and the beating heart of the healthcare system in Gaza is representative of the attack on the healthcare system as a whole in an attempt to deliberately inflict conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of the Palestinian people. Israel besieged and invaded the Shifa Hospital twice, first in November 2023 and again in March 2024, culminating in its complete destruction. During the two-week invasion of the hospital in March, the IOF used the medical facility as a detention and interrogation site, with photos showing Palestinians detained in the hospital courtyard, blindfolded, hands zip-tied, wearing white jumpsuits. Healthcare workers, patients, and civilians were deprived of food, water, medicines, and the basic necessities. In at least one instance, healthcare workers and patients had to share one bottle of water between 15 people. At least 21 patients died during the invasion because healthcare workers were prevented from carrying out their duties. More than 400 people in and around the hospital were killed, including five doctors and several hundred Palestinians that were detained. Among those killed, Dr. Ahmed Al-Makadme and his mother, Dr. Yusra Al-Makadme, whose bodies were found executed near the hospital. Those who survived the invasion of the hospital were evacuated to Al-Ahli Hospital on the 1st of April 2024, where some required limb amputations and whose wounds were infected with maggots as a direct result of the IOF preventing proper medical care to patients during the siege. Three mass graves filled with at least 79 bodies were discovered in the courtyard of Al-Shifa Hospital upon Israeli withdrawal. Several corpses were zip-tied, indicating that they were executed while restrained, while other corpses were severely disfigured. Makeshift burial sites in the hospital courtyard were desecrated by Israeli forces, with human remains visible and exposed above the soil. Similarly, when the IOF withdrew from their siege of the Nasser Hospital on the 7th of April, 2024, they left behind several mass graves filled with 392 bodies. Among the killed were the elderly, women, and wounded patients. Some bodies recovered were found stripped of their clothing and with gunshots to the head or neck. I think it's important to take note of this message that was left by Dr. Mahmoud Abu Najla on the 20th of October, 2023. Whoever stays until the end will tell the story. We did what we could. Remember us. And this is the same message after it was bombed on the 21st of November, 2023. And I think at the very least, we are taking this message and we are doing what we can to tell the story. This is the bare minimum that we can do. So Israel's direct targeting of Al-Shifa Hospital was part of a broader strategy to systematically destroy the healthcare system in its entirety. So in conclusion, the attacks on Gaza's healthcare system as a pattern of genocide that is ongoing and intensifying. On the 20th of March, 2025, Israel blew up the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital. On 23 March, 2025, Israel executed 15 emergency first responders before burying them and their ambulances in a mass grave. On the 13th of May, 2025, Israel directly struck both the Nasser and European hospitals, killing civilians and rendering the European hospital out of service, cutting off access to neurosurgery, cardiac care, and cancer treatment that are unavailable elsewhere in Gaza. Repeated attacks on Gaza's hospitals and healthcare workers are part of a deliberate and systematic pattern to render Gaza unlivable and to destroy Palestinian life.
That was Wissam Ahmed speaking on behalf of Al-Haq organization at the Gaza Tribunal held in Sarajevo in May 2025. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On August 26, 2025, the Florida chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Florida, the state's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization, held a press conference to demand, on behalf of 100 state and national coalition partners, that the U.S. State Department and Florida's elected officials call on the Israeli government to immediately release Mohammed Ibrahim, a 16-year-old Palestinian-American citizen from Florida who has been held without trial in an Israeli prison for more than 6 months. The coalition that consists of U.S. faith-based human rights and civil rights organizations has signed a letter urging the U.S. government to act immediately to secure the release of Mohammed Ibrahim, an American citizen who was unjustly imprisoned by the Israeli occupation army. I'm going to air now most of the remarks delivered at that press conference, and we begin with the remarks of Wilfredo Ruiz, Communications Director at CARE Florida.
My name is Wilfredo Ruiz. I am the Communications Director for the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Florida chapter. Today, we're brought to this press conference because we have a family pleading, calling for the release of a Palestinian American citizen child. A 15-year-old minor was arrested and now detained for around 6 months. He was arrested when he was 15 and now he's 16. And the reason that brought us here, and you're going to hear from multiple organizations that are assisting the family of Mohammed Ibrahim in trying to get this son of Florida back. Mohammed Ibrahim needs to be in America. He's an American citizen, and the American government does have an obligation to protect the American children everywhere where they are in the whole planet, anywhere, including Israel, Gaza, Palestine, wherever. It's an obligation. That's why the governments exist. The first duty is to offer protection to their citizens. And that is the duty we're calling our government to fulfill. The first speaker will be CARE Florida Deputy Executive Director, Sister Heba Rahim. Please.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Heba Rahim. I'm the Deputy Executive Director at CARE Florida. We're here today for Mohammed Ibrahim. He's a 16-year-old American teenager who has been imprisoned by Israel for the last 6 months. He was only 15 years old when he was abducted from his home in the middle of the night, and he has not been able to contact or connect with his family since then. In the last 6 months, he's lost over 25 pounds. That's almost 25% of his body weight. He's contracted scabies. He has not been able to connect with his family. His situation is dire, and we're calling for his release. A coalition of more than 100 statewide, local, and national, and even international organizations are coming together to call for his release. These include the Center for Constitutional Rights, Global Ministries of the Christian Church, Jewish Voices for Peace Action, Pax Christi USA, and Veterans for Peace. There's a legitimate fear that people have right now. His family and his community have a legitimate fear, and that is for his safety. His health is deteriorating. The U.S. Embassy has checked on him and has reported that his health is deteriorating. His scabies was being treated, but he is still suffering from that. And in April of this year, a 17-year-old Palestinian teenager being held at the same prison that Mohammed was held at died because of the abusive conditions there. This is something we have to pay attention to. We have to speak out. And in a turn of good news, we've seen that some elected officials are paying attention and are speaking out. And with that hope, we reach out to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the Department of State, and to President Trump, and we're asking them to work together to secure his release. This is not politics. This is the life of an American teenager who's being held in an Israeli prison, one that is notorious for abuses. And regardless of what type of prison it is, he needs to be back with his family. He's a 16-year-old young American man. We're asking for help to bring him back. Thank you.
Thank you. Heba will be followed by Siad Khadr. Siad is the cousin to Mohammed Ibrahim, and he will relate perhaps the information that the State Department have conveyed to the family and are going to convey some of the indescribable suffering that his family is having in the past weeks, not only because of this abduction, but also for losing another of their family members some weeks ago to illegal Israeli settler violence. So please, Lucia.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is about my nephew, Mohammed. Mohammed is the first cousin of Saifullah. Saifullah was killed a month and a half ago. They both work right down the street here, off of Bruce B. Downs at an ice cream shop. Mohammed was 15 years old, 4 in the morning, 25 soldiers, ski masks, M16s, you know, jeeps, military vehicles. They came into the house. They took him out of his bedroom, blindfolded him, handcuffed him. And that was 6 months and 10 days ago. That's the last time anybody seen him that knows him. We're here, everybody's here, just like any parent, uncle, father, mother. A 16-year-old is supposed to be down the street right now getting his driver's license with his summer job, with his family, who just buried his first cousin. We want him home. Any child belongs with his parents, his mom, and his dad. I just became a father after 20 years of me trying to be a dad. My kids are home with me and their mom. Anybody who's a parent knows what it's like to have their kids near them. And I pray that nobody is going through what his mom and dad are going through. The conditions that he's in and the prison that he's in is notorious for torture and suffering. Hiba just mentioned 25% of his body weight. He's not on Ozempic. He's not on a diet. He's getting starved. Scabies from his feet to his fingertips, begging for ointment to treat him. U.S. Embassy getting denied access because of how contagious it is. Our politicians, from our city council members to the White House, need to do something about this. You know, we're reminded every day that in Israel, they're our biggest ally, they're a democracy, they're the only democracy in the Middle East. Let's have these two democracies talk to each other and get this kid home. Let's see what real democracy is. Let's get our boy back to his family, back to his parents. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Now we're going to have us, Ms. Megan Hammer. Megan is Care Florida's policy director. Megan, please.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking about your cousin. As Hiba and them said today, we are a national, local, and regional coalition that we're calling to bring Mohammed Ibrahim home. So with us today is some of the members of the regional and the local coalition. Although, as Hiba mentioned, there are many national and international organizations, faith-based civil rights, from the Quakers to Veterans for Peace, that have all joined in this call to bring him home, because he is a child and he needs to be with his parents. If you had a child and he was in prison and you were denied to see him for 6 months, you need to set that end. That is not democracy, that is not democratic values, and that is not what we here in the U.S. stand for, nor what Florida stands for. So we ask you all to demand that we bring Mohammed Ibrahim home, and now I'll pass it on to some of our local coalition members that is joining the call to bring him home. Thank you.
Part of the coalition members is Reverend Andy Oliver. Reverend.
Reverend Andy Oliver, pastor of Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg. I stand here today as a Christian pastor compelled by my faith to speak plainly. What is happening to Mohammed Ibrahim is a moral outrage. Mohammed is a child. He is a U.S. citizen from Florida. He is a 16-year-old boy, taken from his home, held without charge, denied medical care, and wasting away before our eyes. The gospel tells us that when Jesus took a child into his arms, he said, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." The U.S. government cannot claim to defend human rights while allowing one of its own children to be caged and starved abroad. Our different faith traditions know the story of a young boy once imprisoned by empire, Joseph, sold into captivity. And we know of Jesus himself arrested, tortured, and executed by the state. Our faith calls us to resist every power that cages, dehumanizes, and kills. And so today I join CARE and over 100 organizations in demanding, bring Mohammed home, release him now. And just to go off script a little bit and hearing your words, I am the father of a 16-year-old. The idea of being separated from him and in him being in these conditions absolutely breaks my heart. And so as a father and as a pastor, I cannot separate Mohammed's suffering from the suffering of an entire people. Palestinian liberation is a moral and spiritual and human imperative. So the cry for Mohammed today is a cry for a people who deserve to live free from the river to the sea. Amen.
Thank you, Robert. We're having Mr. Samuel Ronan from the Progressive Jewish Coalition of Tampa Bay, please.
Thank you. My name is Samuel Ronan from the Progressive Jewish Coalition. I'd like to open this with a quote from the great poet James Baldwin, who says, "The children are always ours, every single one of them, all over the globe. And I am beginning to suspect that whoever is incapable of recognizing this may be incapable of morality." What I believe he means by that is that we all have a communal responsibility to each other. And what that means is, not only do I care about what happens to you, I care about what happens to your children. And while your children may not be mine, I have a responsibility for them. we have a responsibility for them as members of a community, of a neighborhood, and especially a country. And we see it historically that when a people want to dehumanize another group of people, one of the first groups that they go after is the children. And they dehumanize children. And that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about a child. And there may be people that would want to say that Muhammad is an adult. They might want to say that he's a criminal, a thug, a supervillain. No, this is a child. This is a 16-year-old boy. This is someone's child. This is our child. A Floridian child, an American child. And the Progressive Jewish Coalition cannot help but wonder, if this child had my name, looked a little bit more like me, believed as I believed, would he be home already? And I think we all know what that answer would be. And so as PJC, we are calling on the government to treat Mohammed as if he were one of us, because he is. We want them to not abdicate their responsibility to the children of the world. And we also have to call attention to the fact that the occupation of Palestine is built on this kind of dehumanization. So if we want to get him home, and we want to ensure that it never happens again, then we have to see a free Palestine within our lifetime. And we are committed to doing that. And I thank all of you, all of our allies here. Thank you.
And Matt, we have Matt from the Tampa Democratic Socialists of America. Matt, if you would, please.
Matthew Levine. I'm from the Tampa Democratic Socialists of America. DSA is a national organization with over 80,000 dues-paying members. Our biannual convention is the highest decision-making body that we have, and the one we had at the beginning of August, we voted to unequivocally affirm our commitment to Al-Thawabit, the principles that were first set down by the Palestinian National Council in 1977 that include the right to return and the right to self-determination. The National Political Committee is the highest decision-making body of DSA in between conventions, and they just voted to join CARES Coalition to bring Mohammed home, and we're going to do everything that we can to make that happen. Just on a personal note, I am Jewish, and I also organize with the Progressive Jewish Coalition, and DSA has become the home for a lot of anti-Zionist Jews, and there are many anti-Zionist Jews around the world who are all organizing for a free Palestine. We're just going to do everything that we can to bring Mohammed home. Thank you.
We have Ahmed Al-Kanoui, Partners for Palestine. Ahmed.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ahmed Al-Kanoui. On behalf of Partners for Palestine, Partners for Palestine is a multi-faith organization of Americans dedicated to equality, justice, and human rights. Our members from across Florida and beyond are deeply concerned about the imprisonment of Muhammad Ibrahim, a child, a fellow citizen, and in the conditions that violate international law. When a 15-year-old boy on vacation gets abducted from his family home at 3:30 in the morning, by a militia of soldiers stripped away from his mother and his father under the accusation of throwing rocks. In any other country or otherwise, we would hope that our government would be outraged. Our leaders should jump to condemn this. This is an American citizen. This is a minor that was treated with such force. They have no due process, no access to his family. We hear no comments from our elected officials. We see no posts of condemnation. We see no action taken to protect our children. Mohammed is a child, like any of our children, born in this country and entitled with rights and protections of our government, yet he has been left without protection in a foreign country for over 6 months now. His health and his life are in danger. I'll say that again. His health and his life are in danger. Our failure to defend and release him endangers all of us and all of our family members traveling abroad. The members of Partners for Palestine, including over 400 members throughout Florida, call on our elected officials to intervene and bring Mohammed home to his family and community today. We will not rest. We will not be silent until he is free. Thank you.
For the last speaker will be Leali Shalabi, the resistance of Tampa Bay RTB. Please, Leali.
My name is Leali Shalabi, community organizer, journalist, and family friend of Mohammed Ibrahim. Imagine your child just 15 years old, asleep in his bed when soldiers storm in at 3 a.m. They blindfold him, tie his hands, and rip him from your arms. This is what happened to Mohammed Ibrahim, a U.S. citizen from Florida. He turned 16 in a cell in Israel, something no parent would ever want their child's 16th birthday to look like. He is sick with scabies, starved of food, and denied medicine. He has lost over 25 pounds, losing his childhood, losing his life. For 6 months, his mother has not heard him say mama. His father has not heard him say baba. Can you imagine that silence? Can you imagine it being your child? And as Mohammed suffers, his family is already grieving another loss. His cousin, Palestinian-American Saifullah Mosalet, who was beaten to death by Israeli settlers just last month. One family, two American children, one buried, one imprisoned. Mohammed is an American child, and tonight, his life hangs by a thread. We are pleading with the U.S. government, bring him home, protect him, protect all of our children, because no parent should ever have to bury their child because their country chose silence. If Mohammed were your son, you would have moved heaven and earth to bring him home. Sympathize with us. We are pleading to the U.S. government again. His health and his life are in danger. Thank you.
Two young men, same family, same community, crushed by the same systemic violence that the Israeli occupation brings. We cannot stay silent. We cannot stay silent as an American child is being tortured in a prison, whomever prison it is, Israeli, Russian, Korean. We cannot stay silent.
What you just heard were the remarks delivered at the press conference held in Florida demanding the release of American citizen Mohammed Ibrahim, a 16-year-old Palestinian-American abducted and held in Israeli jails for more than 6 months. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. You may or may not have heard about apartheid Israel's war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu's interview in August 2025 with the Israeli I-24 news channel, in which he announced his commitment to the vision of a greater Israel, quote unquote, basically taking over other countries, a Zionist plan to conquer the Arab world. Many already knew about this Zionist plan that apartheid Israel has been working on and executing for over 7 years. But in case you were not aware of that, I'm going to air now a segment produced by BTN, Breakthrough News, titled Greater Israel Explained, the Israeli plan to conquer the Arab world. I actually aired that segment in November 2024, but thought it is worth sharing it again. Let's listen, and the voice you will hear is that of Kay Pritzker, a New York-based journalist and activist with Breakthrough News.
What is Greater Israel? This recently came up after this article in one of the main English-language Israeli newspapers, the Jerusalem Post, went viral. The article was called, Is Lebanon Part of Israel's Promised Territory? And it explains the origins of a concept called Greater Israel. The article reads, in the last generation, the term Greater Israel has come to the forefront. It's sometimes used in political or religious discussions about the ideal or future borders of Israel, often in the context of messianic or Zionist aspirations. Some interpret it as a call for the reestablishment of Israel's biblical borders. However, the concept varies in meaning, ranging from symbolic or spiritual interpretations to literal geographic claims. Greater Israel has been a topic of discussion, especially after Israel's attacks in Lebanon, which revealed a deeper desire within Israel's extreme right to actually begin Jewish settlement in Lebanon. The so-called Israeli Movement for Settlement in Southern Lebanon posted a map of the sites of prospective Jewish settlements with all the Arabic names replaced with Hebrew names. This ideology has had a resurgence lately, largely because Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu formed his coalition government with Messianic Zionist parties. There's a whole documentary by TRT about this called Holy Redemption, Stealing Palestinian Land, and it's worth watching, but this video will focus on the history of the concept. The article in the Jerusalem Post was taken down, but you can read it by using an internet archive site like archive.org, and the article says, quote, "Greater Israel refers to the concept of the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel as promised to the Jewish people in various parts of the Torah. It's often associated with the land described in the covenant with Abraham, which stretches from the river of Egypt to the Prat River." And then it quotes the Torah, "When Hashem, God, promised Abraham the land of Israel, the verse says, 'On that day, God made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates,' which is Mesopotamia or modern day Iraq." While it has religious origins, the Greater Israel concept is referenced from the very first days of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was a movement of European Jews who wanted Jews in Europe to move to Palestine to create a Jewish state. One of the first mentions of Greater Israel is written in the founder of the Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl's diary in 1898, just 1 year after the first Zionist Congress. On page 711 of his diary, Herzl describes the geographic proposal for a hypothetical Jewish state and says that the area demanded will be from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. He then goes on to describe how this area will be slowly transferred from an Arab majority to a Jewish majority. The Zionist movement first presented this map showing what a future Jewish state would look like at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the conference where the World War I surrender terms were being signed. The empires that had won the war, Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, were dividing up the colonies of the losers, the Ottoman and German empires. One of the territories the Ottoman Empire lost was this area here, the Levant. The Levant is the heart of 3,000 years of Arab civilization. For centuries, they lived under the Ottoman Empire, but the empire's collapse during World War I brought hope that Arabs might finally be able to govern themselves. Instead of that, however, the Allied powers took over and created entirely new countries based on completely arbitrary boundaries. The map of the Middle East we know today was literally drawn with pencils and straight edges at a meeting at 10 Downing Street in London, which is the British Prime Minister's office, by two British and French diplomats named Mark Sykes and François Picot. Under the all-too-familiar colonial guise of protecting minorities, the European powers drew states that intentionally divided the region along the lines of sect. This is deeply ironic because Arabs are often accused of being sectarian, that religious and ethnic conflict is just part of their culture. But these distinctions between Christians and Muslims, Shia and Sunni, Arab and Kurd, were really exploited and exaggerated by the British and French, not Arabs. They literally tried to bake conflict into these countries, a legacy which still hasn't gone away today. This divide and conquer strategy is the textbook strategy of colonialism and can be observed in just about every single colonial situation in history. Part of the British strategy in Palestine was to hand over their mandate to the pro-Western, pro-colonial Zionist movement. The Paris Peace Conference of 1919, where the British and French were dividing up the spoils of World War I, is where the Zionist movement first presented its proposal for the borders of a future Jewish state. The map presented by then leading Zionist activist and future first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, was drawn by the World Zionist Organization and included the East Bank, which is the eastern side of the Jordan River, part of southern Lebanon, and the Egyptian Sinai. The map was rejected by Britain and France, and what followed was a long debate over what the borders of the future Jewish state should be. One of the leading proponents of expansive settlement was this guy, Zev Jabotinsky, a leader of the hard-right revisionist wing of the Zionist movement. At the 1931 Zionist Congress, Jabotinsky actually split the Zionist movement over the question of Transjordan being included in a future Jewish state because he felt it was such a crucial aspect. This is notable because Jabotinsky is considered the ideological forefather of the Likud party, the party of Benjamin Netanyahu. His most famous writing, The Iron Wall, is an essay he wrote in 1923 that argued that there would never be a voluntary agreement over European settlement in Palestine because, in his own words, there's never been a historical instance of a colonial project getting consent from the native population. He argued the only way a Jewish state could be established is if Jewish settlers create an iron wall which the natives couldn't breach. The essay is only 7 pages long, and it's definitely worth reading. Israel declares independence in 1948, but in its entire history, Israel's never actually defined its own borders. Israel's borders have changed almost constantly in its 70-year history because it's always conquering or trying to conquer more land. In 1948, Israel expelled Palestinians into neighboring countries to create a Jewish-majority state. In 1967, Israel fought the Six-Day War. The popular Israeli narrative of this war is that all of the Arab governments woke up one day and randomly attacked Israel because they hate Jews. But the truth is, Israel provoked a war with the Arab states intentionally. This was openly admitted by several high-level Israeli generals after the war. Matthew Peled, one of the Israeli commanders in the Six-Day War, told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, "The thesis that the danger of genocide was hanging over us in June 1967 and that Israel was fighting for its physical existence is only a bluff, which was born and developed after the war." In the 1967 war, Israel conquers all of historic Palestine, the Egyptian Sinai, and the Syrian Golan Heights, more than doubling its territory. The UN does force Israel to return the Sinai, but Israel refuses to leave the Syrian Golan Heights, which is still under Israeli occupation today. One of the major turning points for Israel is its 1982 invasion of Lebanon. It was Israel's first attempt at a major occupation of a country outside of historic Palestine. But even before Israel's invasion, it had been using Christian sects in Lebanon as proxies to fight the Palestinian liberation fighters in the south of the country. Lebanese Christian fascists famously served as the trigger pullers in the Israeli-orchestrated Sabra and Shatila massacres, where 3,000 Palestinian refugees were executed over the course of a day and a half in what the UN General Assembly condemned as an act of genocide. One of the visions for Israel's long-term strategic outlook to come out of this invasion was laid out by an aide to the Israeli Minister of Defense at the time, Ariel Sharon. The strategy paper, called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which was published by the World Zionist Organization's ideological journal, Kivunim, or Directions in Hebrew, explains in thorough detail how Israel should exploit the sectarian divisions in other Arab countries, as they did in Lebanon, in a larger strategy to fracture the Arab world. It says, quote, "The Muslim Arab world is built like a temporary house of cards, put together by foreigners without the wishes and desires of the inhabitants having been taken into account. It was arbitrarily divided into 19 states, all made of combinations of minorities and ethnic groups which are hostile to one another, so that every Arab Muslim state nowadays faces ethnic social destruction from within, and in some, a civil war is already raging." Then it goes on to say, "Syria is fundamentally no different from Lebanon. The real civil war taking place nowadays between the Sunni majority and the Shia Alawite ruling minority testifies to the severity of the domestic trouble. Iraq is, once again, no different in essence from its neighbors, although its majority is Shia and the ruling minority is Sunni." It then lays out its strategy for what it calls the Eastern Front. The dissolution of Syria and Iraq later on into ethnically or religiously unique areas such as in Lebanon is Israel's primary target. In the long run, while the dissolution of the military power of those states serves as the primary short-term target, Syria will fall apart in accordance with its ethnic and religious structure. This state of affairs will be the guarantee for peace and security in the area in the long run, meaning for Israel, and that aim is already within our reach today. If you observe the strategy followed by Benjamin Netanyahu throughout his career, it follows this strategy almost exactly. In 2002, he urged Congress to invade Iraq over the weapons of mass destruction it never had. The US occupation plunged Iraq into a bloody sectarian civil war by manipulating balances between the Shia and Sunni Muslims. In Syria, Israel held an official position of neutrality, but later admitted to arming the mostly Sunni rebels while simultaneously carrying out regular attacks against the government, which was controlled by Shia Alawites, in a situation where neutrality actually meant for Israel undermining both sides in a civil war. And of course, in Lebanon today, we see Israel collectively punishing the Lebanese people and then telling non-Muslims to blame Muslims for Israeli airstrikes. My question for you is, how long will you tolerate this? Israel has killed over 40,000 people in Gaza, and if you include non-combat deaths, that number is conservatively estimated to be around 200,000. Immediately after committing the most well-documented attempt to wipe out an entire city in history, Israel turns around and commits an attack that turns civilian mobile devices into a theater of war, kills around 1,000 people in the span of 2 or 3 days, and then assassinates the very person likely to trigger a regional war. Israel has proven at every single juncture in the last year that it is the greatest threat to world peace right now. I've heard a lot of people describe this as the cause of our time. And while there are very few moments in history where there's a system of government that's so inhumane and so repugnant that the world unites against it, it has happened. And if Israel's actions don't merit that, then what does? The passage of a UN resolution calling for an arms embargo against Israel was a good start, but it actually needs to be enforced. And I'll just say on a parting note that the cartoonish caricature of the Middle East as a region that's just hopelessly condemned to thousand-year-old ethnic and religious conflicts is one of the greatest lies that's ever been perpetuated in the post-9/11 era. This narrative, which convinced millions of people that turmoil and conflict were intrinsic parts of Arab society, concealed the reality that these were really intrinsic parts of British and French colonial strategy and US world domination. After the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, an American fact-finding mission was created to survey the opinions of the people of the Levant to see what kind of future government they wanted. Taken in 1919, the King Crane Commission surveyed 1,520 villages in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Transjordan. Of the 2.5 million Muslims, 500,000 Christians, 100,000 Jews, and 100,000 Druze that were surveyed, a full 80% of respondents voted for this option here. Greater Syria, which was the concept for a unified pan-Arab state that would have combined Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Transjordan into one country. Greater Syria obviously never came into fruition because it would have been unacceptable to the colonial powers of the time, but it's interesting to think back on given what we know today. The whole thesis of that 1982 Israeli strategy memo was premised on the idea that Pan-Arabism was dead. But if anything, the last year has shown us that Pan-Arabism is still highly relevant, not just to the question of Palestine, but the region as a whole. For the last 30 years, Israel has been normalizing its presence in the region by making peace agreements with Arab states one by one, thereby isolating the issue of Palestine and creating a permanent beachhead for US and Israeli imperialism. But the last year not only shattered this possibility, it showed definitively that the mass of Arab people still considered the Palestinian cause an Arab cause and a cause of their own, and refused to see it abandoned like their leaders have. It's not surprising that the 1982 memo was contingent on the absence of Arab unity. Unity has always spelled the downfall of empires, and Israel isn't likely to be an exception.
That was Kay Pritzker with Breakthrough News at www.breakthroughnews.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.